In the grim darkness of the far future, serving as an Imperial Guardsman is already a death sentence in slow motion. They say the average life expectancy of a guardsman in active combat is about 15 hours, and that's in a good unit on a good day. Now, imagine being the poor soul with a job so awful that 15 hours sounds like a luxury. The Astra Militarum, Imperial Guard, is a vast war machine powered by countless human lives, and within it are jobs so dangerous and thankless that even a hardened conscript might flinch. Today we're going to walk through the worst jobs you can have in the Imperial Guard. These are the assignments that make a frontline trench trooper look lucky. From carrying volatile fuel on your back to charging enemy guns with a knife, these are truly the worst of the worst. Each of these roles is a one-way ticket to an early grave, or worse. And if you ever find yourself conscripted into the Guard, you'd pray to the Guard Emperor that you end up anywhere else but here. Brace yourself and be thankful this is just a tale and not your reality. Here are the most horrific, dangerous, and utterly undesirable jobs in the Imperial Guard. In this cruel galaxy, only in death does duty end. And for these jobs, that end usually comes all too quickly. Flamer Operator, if you have a death wish and a love of bonfires, becoming a Flamer Operator might sound appealing. This is the poor guardsman tasked with wielding a flamethrower, essentially a tank of highly flammable promethium strapped to his back, attached to a nozzle that spews burning fuel. The Imperial cult may call fire the cleansing flame of the Emperor's wrath. But for a flamer trooper, it feels a lot like carrying your own future cremation on your shoulders. It's hard to find a more dangerous combination than being extremely close to your enemy while also wearing something that will explode if hit. Being a flamer operator means you fight at point-blank range by design. While your fellow guardsmen are trading last gunfire from a relatively safe distance, you're the unlucky soul who has to get within a few meters of horrifying enemies. Whether it's a horde of charging orcs, a wall of Tyranid biomonstrosities, or a bunker full of heretics, and bathe them in flame. Sure, the flamer can wash a whole squad of foes in liquid fire, turning them into screaming torches. It's devastating against packed enemies or in tight trenches. But the catch is, you must get close enough to smell the burning flesh to do your job. And you will smell a lot of burning flesh. Some of it might even be your own. Walking around with a giant promethium tank on your back makes you a priority target. Enemy snipers and marksmen love to pick off flamer operators. One shot to your fuel tank and you'll erupt like a human firebomb, potentially taking some comrades with you. Even without precision shots, stray bullets and shrapnel are everywhere on a battlefield. It only takes one piece of hot metal in the wrong spot, and suddenly the guy with the flamer turns into a blazing pillar of fire, and likely a fine red mist. There's a reason nobody wants to march too close to the walking bomb in their squad. Let's not forget the psychological toll. Incinerating enemies at close quarters is gruesome work. The screams of those being burned alive will haunt you. The Imperial Creed might preach that purging with flame is righteous, but the guardsman pulling the trigger still has to watch people, or aliens, flailing and shrieking as they burn. The stench of promethium and charred bodies clings to your uniform, your hair, your lungs. Many flamer operators quickly acquire a 1,000-yard stare, assuming their eyebrows haven't been singed off first. Then there are the environmental hazards. Use a flamer in a confined space, like a bunker or a hive city corridor, and you might suck all the oxygen out of the room or flood it with thick, toxic smoke. There's a real chance you'll asphyxiate yourself and your fellow guardsmen while trying to roast the enemy. Or you might trigger secondary explosions if the environment is full of combustibles. A dangerous feedback for someone standing only a few meters away with a fuel tank on their back. Using a flamethrower can also light up all kinds of unintended things. Promethium doesn't discriminate between a heretic and, say, a pile of stored munitions or a gas pocket in the terrain. It's all equally flammable and explosive. Operating a flamethrower is physically punishing as well. The Promethium tank and flamer unit are heavy. You're lugging tens of kilograms of fuel and metal, which is exhausting before you even factor in the sweltering heat. Firing the weapon turns the air around you into an oven. In a jungle or desert, igniting that flamer is like stepping into a blast furnace. You risk cooking yourself while you cook the enemy. Even on an icy tundra battlefield, you might welcome the warmth for a split second, until a gust blows the flames back at you or a ruptured fuel line bathes you in burning gel. In summary, being a flamer operator means volunteering to be a walking inferno in the midst of battle. Life expectancy is dismally short. One moment you're engulfing the enemy in righteous fire, the next a lucky shot ignites your tank and you become a brief human torch. It's a spectacular but nearly suicidal role, truly one of the worst jobs in the Guard. Field medic. On a sane world in a sane time, being a field medic might be seen as a noble calling, a healer amidst war. In the Imperial Guard, it's one of the most heartbreaking and hazardous roles you can draw. A field medic, also known as a combat medique or chirurgeon, is a soldier who carries a medkit into battle, rushing to patch up wounded comrades in the heat of combat. It's a job that demands courage, compassion, and a stomach of steel. And the reality is that even the bravest medic often ends up as just another corpse on the field, sometimes right beside the man he was trying to save. Picture this. You're huddled in a muddy shell crater while las bolts zip overhead and artillery shakes the ground. Suddenly, someone nearby screams, "Medic!" a cry that cuts through the chaos. That's your cue. While every sensible person is ducking for cover, you have to sprint out into that storm of gunfire and shrapnel toward the poor soul who's bleeding out. You might be crawling on your belly to reach a wounded trooper, mud and blood smearing your uniform as enemy shots kick up dirt around you. The entire time, the enemy doesn't care that you're trying to help someone. To them, you're just another target. There's no Geneva Convention in the 41st millennium. A medic crawling toward a fallen friend might as well have a bullseye painted on their back. Being a medic means your mind is constantly racing with split-second decisions. Is that injured trooper savable or beyond help? Can you actually get to him without being shot yourself? If you do reach him, can you stabilize him quickly, or will working on him just get both of you killed? These are the brutal calculations a medic makes daily. And Emperor forbid the soldier you're trying to save is too far gone. You might have to administer the Emperor's mercy, a fatal overdose of painkiller or a last pistol shot to swiftly end agony. Imagine the psychological toll of playing savior and executioner in the same hour, over and over, with your fellow soldiers as the patients. Medical supplies are always limited. A guardsman medic's kit is usually a ragtag collection of coagulant powder, sarets of painkillers, bandages, often just ripped cloth, maybe a hand-cranked injector or stimulant vial, and a whole lot of improvisation. Often, you make do with what you have. Turn a bayonet into a scalpel, a strip of uniform into a tourniquet, whatever it takes. High-tech medicy devices exist, autosanguine pumps, nano-sutures. But on the front line, you rarely see those. You use a canteen to wash a wound, your combat knife to dig out shrapnel, and a steady hand to stitch a gash while under fire. It's messy, frantic, and frequently futile work. Then there's the glamour of the job, blood, mud, and worse all over you. pretty much all the time. A field medic becomes intimately familiar with gore. You might be elbow deep in a screaming man's abdomen trying to clamp an artery, or holding a severed limb against a stump while spraying synth skin foam to seal it. The sights and smells of opened bodies and burning flesh become your world. If you had a weak stomach, not anymore. War cures or kills that quick. Many medics end up performing amputations with only the crudest tools. A battlefield amputation might mean using a chainsword or saw to cut off a mangled leg before infection or gangrene sets in. No anesthetic beyond a shot of painkiller or a belt to bite on. Then you pray the patient doesn't go into fatal shock. This is combat medicine in the guard, brutal, rudimentary, and done in the worst conditions imaginable. Ironically, medics often double as the squad's stimulant dispensers, too. In the Imperial Guard's brutal reality, if a soldier isn't outright dead, the priority is often to get him back on his feet and firing, even if only for a little while longer. Got a gaping shrapnel wound but can still hold a last gun? Here's a syringe of Frenzon or some slot combat drugs. Basically a cocktail of adrenaline and pain suppressors to jolt you up for the next charge. Never mind that you'll probably collapse and die after the chems wear off. The medic's done his job if you stay alive and keep shooting for the next 10 minutes of the firefight. Veteran field chirurgeons are notorious for this. They'll jab a stimulant straight into a dying man's heart and bellow at him to get back in the fight. The soldier, half dead but high as a skyboard, charges one last time. He often dies shortly after, but maybe his last few moments of frenzy turned the tide. It's a cruel miracle medics perform, sacrificing a bit more of a man's life to win the battle. Triage in the field is brutal. With limited medicine, a medic often must decide who can be saved and who is beyond help. You might have to let some wounded men die, or give them the Emperor's mercy, so that others have a chance. Those decisions weigh heavily on any sane person, but you have no choice. You carry on, or everyone dies. A field medic quickly learns to harden his heart, at least outwardly. Some cope with dark humor. I'm really a morale officer. I give our boys peace of mind one way or another. A medic might joke while brandishing a giant syringe. But inside, every loss and every grim choice leaves a scar. Medics are also prime targets for some enemies. Snipers and ruthless foes know killing the healer can demoralize a squad. So wearing a medic's Red Cross or Aquila badge can paint a bullseye on you. In a chaotic battle, you might be leaning over a wounded friend when a well-aimed shot from afar cuts you down because the enemy saw you were trying to save lives. Mercy has no protection on the battlefields of the 41st millennium. If anything, it makes you even more of a target. In short, the field medic is one of the most heroic yet cursed roles in the Guard. You're the difference between life and death for others, but you rarely get to save anyone for long. The best you can do is patch a comrade up to fight and possibly die another day. More often you die kneeling over a fallen guardsman, having risked everything only to join the countless dead. Little wonder many medics don't survive long, and those who do carry scars, both seen and unseen. Heavy bolter loader. You might think operating a big gun in the Imperial Guard is a cushy assignment. After all, you wield some serious firepower, but that's if you're the one behind the trigger. Woe betide the poor soul assigned as the heavy bolter loader, the other half of a heavy weapons team. His job is exactly what it sounds like, lugging around ammunition and feeding the Imperial Guard's heavy bolter, a weapon affectionately nicknamed the Backbreaker. That nickname? It's not a joke. The heavy bolter is a beast of a gun. It fires fist-sized explosive rounds at terrifying rates. And as the loader, you carry the literal and figurative weight of this monster. Let's talk about the physical aspect first. A heavy bolter with its tripod mount is cumbersome. The loader often has to haul the tripod or mounting, plus cases of .998 caliber bolt ammunition. These aren't cute little bullets. Each round is like a small grenade. All told, you might be hauling dozens of extra kilos on top of your normal kit. While everyone else is exhausted on a long march or charge, you're absolutely slogging. Back screaming, legs shaking. Yet you can't slow down or the big gun goes silent. It's common for loaders to arrive at a firing position already drenched in sweat and gasping for air, even before the real fighting kicks off. Ah yes, the gunner. The guy next to you who actually fires the heavy bolter. You two are a team. In theory, you're battle buddies who watch each other's backs. In practice, the loader is often like a servant to a knight, doing the grunt work so the gunner can play hero with the big gun. A good gunner appreciates his loader. A bad one will blame you for every jam or delay. Feed faster. Clear that jam. All while shots fly overhead. It's a thankless pressure cooker of a job. Under enemy fire, you're rushing to open ammo boxes, link belts, and swap them into the feed, all while the gunner is screaming for more ammo now, now, now. If the heavy bolter overheats or malfunctions, which they often do, guess who's frantically trying to fix it? Not the gunner. He's busy cursing or praying. It's you, the loader, who gets that fun duty. And heavy bolters love to jam at the worst times. With such a high rate of fire, it's almost guaranteed that spent casings or links will gum up the works eventually. So picture this. You're in a defensive line, a tide of enemies charging. Your heavy bolter is laying down a glorious stream of explosive death until it goes clunk, jammed. The gunner swears and ducks, and now it's up to you to pop open the feed, yank out the smoking hot jammed bolt, burning your fingers in the process, slap the weapon back together, and do it all in seconds so you don't get overrun. The pressure is enormous. If you fumble, your position might be swarmed by the enemy. Many loaders have died with a half-cleared jammed round still in their hands. Speaking of being overrun, heavy weapons teams are high-priority targets for the enemy. It makes sense. Your heavy bolter can chew through infantry and even light vehicles, so enemy commanders, snipers, and anyone with a grenade will try to take you out ASAP. As the loader, you're often hugging the dirt while sniper rounds crack past and mortars start zeroing in on your muzzle flash. If an incoming shell lands nearby, the gunner might be turned to red mist instantly, direct hit on the gun position. If you're a few meters away fetching ammo, you might get thrown by the blast with shrapnel in your back. And now you have no gunner and likely no heavy bolter either. Now you're just another rifleman, probably an injured one, facing an overwhelming enemy. Not a great spot to be in. Heavy teams can't retreat easily. Once set up, you're often ordered to hold your ground at all costs, which means you might die in place if the enemy breaks through. Trying to reposition a heavy bolter quickly when things go bad is like trying to drag a vault while under fire. Many loaders and gunners end up as dead heroes in their firing pits, their gun emplacement overrun simply because they physically couldn't fall back fast enough. And if foes get in close, you have to drop the ammo belt and grab a last gun or sidearm. But two men with rifles against a rampaging orc or a flurry of bayonet-wielding cultists are desperate odds. Heavy weapon crews aren't built for melee. If it comes to close combat, you're in dire straits. Many loaders meet a grisly end hand-to-hand, fighting with a knife or pistol in a last stand by their jammed, empty heavy bolter. They call the heavy bolter the backbreaker for good reason. As a loader, you endure punishing labor under fire, and often have a tragically short lifespan. The job is brutal, exhausting, and usually thankless. If you do it well, the gunner gets the glory. If you mess up, everyone knows. It quite literally breaks men, physically and mentally. It's an essential role, but it's one of the worst jobs you can draw in the Guard. Scout, reconnaissance trooper. If you've ever thought your job was lonely, try being an Imperial Guard scout. Scouts and reconnaissance troopers are those tasked with going ahead of the main force, operating in small teams or even alone, sneaking through deadly terrain to locate the enemy, gather intel, and call in targets. It's a vital role, the eyes and ears of the regiment, but it's also one of the most perilous and nerve-wracking jobs imaginable. When you're a scout, you are deep in enemy territory or out on the fringes with minimal support. The rest of your company might be kilometers behind you. If you run into trouble, reinforcements aren't coming, at least not in time to save your hide. Your duty is to avoid detection while getting close enough to observe enemy movements, map ambush sites, maybe mark targets for artillery or airstrikes. It's a constant balance of daring and caution. One snapped twig or a glint off your scope, and suddenly you become the hunted. Recon troopers often say the hardest part is feeling the crosshair on your back every second, knowing if an enemy spots you, you probably won't spot them before they pull the trigger. Scouts typically carry specialized gear, a camo cloak, if their regiment is lucky enough to have them, to blend in. Maybe a silenced sniper rifle or a trusty LAS gun with a scope, AuSpex motion trackers, and their wits. But all the gadgets in the galaxy won't save you if you stumble into a lictor's feeding ground at night or crawl into the path of an orc patrol. A lot of recon work comes down to old-fashioned skill, moving silently, using cover, having the patience of a saint. You might lie belly down in toxic mud for 6 hours, observing an enemy camp through magnoculars, trying not to cough despite the spores in the air, because one sound or a single motion could be your end. And when you finally got what you need, you must slip away unseen. Sometimes the enemy will deliberately let a scout retreat, only to follow them back to their lines. If you're unlucky, you could inadvertently lead a kill team right to your buddies. That kind of nightmare scenario hangs over every move a scout makes. Depending on the world, being a scout could mean braving natural dangers before you even find the enemy. On a death world jungle, each step might sink you into quicksand or disturb a venomous plant. Night scouting on an ice planet? You might freeze in place if you don't keep moving, but moving makes you easier to spot. Recon in a ruined hive city? One wrong turn and you plunge 50 stories down a collapsed hab-block shaft. Many scouts don't even die from enemy bullets. They fall victim to the planet itself, deadly fauna, toxic pits, or just plain getting lost and never found. Let's say you do spot the enemy successfully. Now you might have to act as a forward observer to call in the big guns. That involves creeping close enough to the foe to radio precise coordinates for artillery or airstrikes. So you're low to the ground, whispering into a vox, calling down hellfire on an enemy column that might be just a few hundred meters away. You're near enough that a miscalculation could drop shells on your own head. Even if the barrage succeeds, you've stirred up a hornet's nest. Surviving enemies will scour every bush and crater for the spotter, you. If it fails, the foe still knows someone's out there and will hunt you down. Either way, once you call in the rain of fire, you become the prime target. It's like kicking a beehive and then trying to hide from the enraged swarm. Even when things go right, a scout's existence is solitary and mentally taxing. Days or weeks without seeing anyone but the enemies you're tracking. Eating cold rations in the rain under a bush, trying to catch sleep curled in a camo cloak with one eye open. The tension never leaves you. Many scouts become quiet, hyper-vigilant phantoms, more at home crawling through mud than in a camp with fellow soldiers. If a scout goes missing, they might never be found or even noticed in the chaos of war. Just another body in a gulch somewhere, or a name on a report marked MIA. A quick death in a firefight might almost be kinder than dying slowly from injury or exposure alone out there. Of course, successful scouts are highly valued. They can save entire regiments by warning of ambushes or finding a safe path, but their reward is usually being sent on even more dangerous missions, a cruel cycle where surviving just means a deadlier task next. There's an old saying among guardsmen, if you can see the enemy can see you. The scout's addendum is, and the scout probably saw both first. They often witness the horror to come before anyone else, whether it's stumbling on a massacre site or realizing that distant ridge is actually the carapace of a Tyranid Bio-Titan. There's no nope, I'm out button for a scout. They radio what they saw, then try to slip away. Often it's already too late. In some, being a scout means living on a knife's edge far from help. It demands exceptional skill and steel nerves, yet even those might not save you from sheer bad luck or the monstrosities lurking in the dark. Scouts seldom get celebrated. If they fail, they're dead and forgotten. If they succeed, their effort just clears the way for someone else's glory. It's a lonely, perilous calling, certainly one of the worst and most mentally straining jobs in the Guard. Frontline infantry with a bayonet. Every guardsman is issued a bayonet, a simple knife that turns a rifle into a spear. Most hope they never have to use it, but there are moments in the Imperial Guard where fix bayonets becomes the order of the day. That order separates the truly doomed from the merely unlucky. Being a frontline infantryman is already a terrible lot. Being one ordered to charge with the bayonet is perhaps the quintessential experience of the guardsman, and not in a good way. It's a job description that boils down to run straight at the enemy and stab them before they kill you. We're talking about the classic human wave assault. When ammo is low or when a position must be taken at all costs, Imperial commanders, or commissars, aren't shy about sending flesh and blood against the guns. If you're on the receiving end of that command, you and hundreds of your fellow soldiers will climb out of your trench or cover and sprint across open ground toward enemy lines, bayonets gleaming. You scream, "For the Emperor!" at the top of your lungs because, honestly, it's better than thinking about how much incoming fire is about to chew through your ranks. In those moments, every guardsman becomes a bayonet-charging warrior. But for some poor souls, this is basically their whole battlefield existence, especially in penal units or conscript waves, where there's little ammo and lots of bodies. What are you charging at? Often something far more dangerous than you, like an entrenched heavy gun or a giant alien brute. Charging a foe with a blade when they have bullets or are 8 feet tall with cleavers is as grim as it sounds. Most likely, you'll be cut down before you get close. If you do reach them, you're facing an opponent who can probably kill you in one swing. An orc knob is built like a bull and wields a cleaver the size of your torso. A Chaos Space Marine stands in power armor, shrugging off lash shots and cackling at your knife. But the guard charges anyway, because orders are orders, and fear of the commissar's bolt pistol behind you can momentarily outrun fear of the enemy to your front. Up close on a 41st millennium battlefield is a nightmare. This is where guns fall silent, and it's man against monster, face to face. You see the whites of your enemy's eyes, or the glow of their bionic visors, or the multiple eyes of a Xenos. The distance closes in heartbeats. You thrust your bayonet and pray it finds a mark. Often it doesn't. Maybe it glances off armor or sticks uselessly in a rib. Then it's chaos, screaming, stabbing, rifle butts swinging, bodies dropping. It's primal, brutal brawling in mud and blood. Coordination is gone. It's every soldier for themselves in a whirlwind of violence and terror. The things you witness in that melee, they stick with you. if you survive. If you hesitate even a second in that frenzy, you're done. Perhaps you see the face of a boy no older than 16 on the enemy side and falter. That boy might gut you with a rusty bayonet. Or you trip over a corpse. The enemy will seize that moment to smash your skull with a rifle butt. It's kill or be killed, with no room for mercy or doubt. Many do break and try to run or freeze in panic, and that's why commissars often join these charges, pistol drawn. The man behind you might shoot you if you don't keep rushing forward. In a bayonet charge, terror comes from both directions. On the rare chance a charge actually succeeds and you capture the enemy trench, you'll find your unit decimated and fresh enemies already preparing a counterattack. You barely have time to catch your breath or tend wounds before you're expected to hold against a furious counter-push. The ground you took is now the ground you die on. Often, the position you seized is so exposed and battered that holding it is nearly impossible. But stand and die you must, because retreat is not an option in the guard's playbook. It's painfully clear how outmatched a guardsman with a bayonet is against many 41st millennium foes. A knife on a rifle is nearly useless against a Chaos Marine's power armor or a rampaging orc's thick hide. Yet time and again the guard charges anyway. They rely on sheer numbers and faith that the enemy can be drowned in human fury. Sometimes it works. A tide of flesh overruns a position by pure mass and momentum. Often it doesn't, ending in heaps of bodies for negligible gain. Either way, it is horrifying for those in the wave. The only small mercy is that adrenaline dulls fear in the moment. Many troopers report the whole experience as a blur. In the fury of a bayonet charge, some say they don't even remember what happened. Just a red haze, some flashes of panic and fury, and then waking up bloodied, if they're lucky, or not waking at all. A few rare individuals even find a grim thrill in that madness, reveling in the hand-to-hand fight. But those types usually don't last long either, eventually meeting a gruesome end. To summarize, a bayonet charge is the embodiment of the Imperium's brutal strategy of attrition. You are an expendable human wave thrown against impossible odds. Victory, if it comes, is paid for in rivers of blood. Most often, it's just a pointless massacre. The fact that the Imperial Guard still resorts to such tactics shows how desperate and callous the war for survival is. For the poor souls with bayonets fixed, it's a near-suicidal mission every time. Undeniably one of the worst jobs a soldier can be tasked with. Vox operator. Any guard unit that can't communicate is dead already, goes an old saying. The Vox operator is the guardsman who carries and operates the portable communications gear, the Vox caster, that links squads with their commanders, artillery support, and the rest of the army. It's a critical job. Without it, a squad is isolated and blind. However, being the walking telephone pole of the platoon is far from a safe desk job. In fact, it's another role with a tragically short life expectancy and a heavy burden in every sense. First off, that Vox caster pack is heavy and bulky. Imagine wearing a small piece of a communication tower on your back, complete with a tall antenna sticking up. It weighs on your shoulders and makes you an awkward shape in cover. And good luck keeping a low profile. That aerial might as well be a flag saying, shoot me. You can't exactly duck easily with a 2-meter whip antenna revealing your position. If enemy spotters see that spike bobbing along the trench line, they know someone important is there. That leads to the next problem. Target priority. Smart enemies know that cutting off the guard's communications can sow chaos. If they spot a Vox antenna or hear you yelling into a handset, they'll take aim. A sniper sees two guardsmen, one regular and one with a tall antenna. Guess which one he'll shoot first. Even up close, foes know the soldier shouting into a radio is up to no good for them, so they'll try to silence you quickly. Many a Vox trooper has caught a bullet while busy transmitting, because the enemy recognized the Vox and decided to make the guard fight uncoordinated. Speaking of calling for artillery, being a Vox operator often means acting as a forward spotter as well. That's a double-edged sword. Yes, you can summon a rain of shells or an airstrike when things get nasty, but if those coordinates are off by a hair, you might bring death on your own squad. Under fire and stress, one misquoted coordinate can bring friendly shells down on your heads. That knowledge is a heavy burden. A single slip of the tongue might doom your comrades or yourself. It's happened before. So while you're fumbling with the Vox unit under fire, trying to read a map grid with shaking hands, you know that messing up could make you very unpopular or very dead. Then there's the content of what you hear. As a Vox operator, you're tuned in to company and regimental channels. You hear the screams of other units calling for evac or begging for reinforcements. You catch the panicked last words of squads being overrun. All that horror pours directly into your ears, and you can't turn it off. The psychological toll of hearing the wider battlefield's death and despair is immense. While a regular trooper is focused on the fight in front of him, a Vox operator is painfully aware of dozens of fights going on and losing all at once. It's like being the switchboard for a symphony of carnage. The gear itself can be finicky under combat conditions. Vox units are rugged, but battlefields are hell on electronics. If it breaks or jams mid-fight, you have to fix it yourself, maybe slapping it, retuning dials, even jury-rigging a new antenna out of bent wire, all while crouching under fire. A malfunction at the wrong moment can be as deadly as an enemy bullet, since a silent squad might as well be invisible to support. Imagine scrambling to repair a Vox set with lasbolts flying overhead, praying to the Omnissiah that your gadget sparks back to life before your position is overrun. Not fun. Oh, and guess what? Carrying a Vox doesn't exempt you from being a soldier. You've got your LAS gun, slung awkwardly around the Vox unit's straps, and you're expected to fight like everyone else. But if a threat pops up while you're mid-transmission, you might catch a bullet simply because you were looking at the dial instead of scanning for danger for one crucial second. A Vox operator's situational awareness is split one ear in the speaker, one eye on the battlefield, and that can be a fatal distraction. If the squad leader goes down, often the Vox operator becomes the lifeline for command and sometimes even de facto squad leader. Orders from above will come through you now. You might suddenly have a commander barking for a situation report that your dead sergeant would have given. Now you're juggling the radio while trying to keep your panicking squad mates in order. You're not trained for this, usually, but the guard doesn't care. You're the communicator, so communicate. It's a trial by fire that leaves many Vox troopers overwhelmed, or worse, frozen at the worst possible time. All things considered, the Vox operator's job is one of constant stress and high visibility. You carry the weight, literally and figuratively, of keeping your unit connected under fire, while knowing you're a prime target. You hear every desperate call, feel responsible for every cry for help that you may or may not answer in time. The best outcome is that you call in support exactly when needed and maybe save the day. But you'll rarely get credit. The worst outcome is you die with your Vox set still crackling on your back, your final transmission cut short. It's often a thankless, deadly role, one of the worst assignments a guardsman can get. Chimera driver, transport operator. Tanks and armored vehicles are often seen as havens in war-thick armor protecting you from the worst of it. But if you think driving the Imperial Guard's ubiquitous Chimera transport is a safe gig, think again. Being a Chimera driver is a masterclass in claustrophobic dread. You're sealed in a metal box, rumbling into the teeth of enemy fire, responsible for a dozen lives in the back, and all the while knowing that one well-placed anti-tank round can turn your armored personnel carrier into a steel coffin. The Chimera is the Guard's workhorse armored transport, a tracked metal box with a turret on top, carrying up to a dozen infantry. As the driver, you sit at the front, peering through narrow vision slits or periscopes. Your world is reduced to a tiny view, often a green tint Auspex screen or a hand's breadth slit of daylight, which means you're driving half blind. You rely on your commander or crewmates to guide you, because if they miss a threat, say a hidden mine or a lurking tank killer, you'll find out when it hits you, quite literally. You have almost no peripheral vision. You could roll straight past an enemy ambusher a few meters away and never know until he sticks a melta bomb to your hull. One of the biggest threats is anti-tank weaponry. The moment you roll out in a Chimera, any enemy with a missile launcher, Lascannon, or even a crude rocket will zero in on you. After all, you're moving cover for a squad. Take out the transport and you strand the troops. The Chimera's armor is decent against small arms, but a single well-aimed missile can punch right through. And guess who sits in the front, right where many anti-tank shots hit? The driver. There's a reason many drivers tape a little Aquila or a prayer card on the control panel. When a rocket streaks in, survival often comes down to blind luck or the Emperor's grace. If you do survive the initial impact, it's likely because you're trapped in a burning wreck. Even mobility itself becomes a weapon turned against you. Landmines and improvised explosives are a constant fear. Hit a mine and you might lose a track and be stranded in a kill zone, or just be blown apart outright in a single deafening blast. If you're lucky enough to be merely immobilized, now you're a sitting duck. A stationary Chimera in a firefight attracts everything the enemy has. Many drivers die without ever seeing the enemy. A buried explosive or anti-tank trap simply obliterates them out of nowhere. Trying to crawl out a tiny hatch while on fire is as horrific as it sounds, and few guardsmen manage it in time. Then there's the pressure of responsibility. You're carting around a dozen fellow soldiers who rely on you to get them in and out of hell safely. When incoming fire is ricocheting off the hull and everyone in the passenger bay is shouting, "Go, go, go, oh!" it's on you to keep cool and get the vehicle and its occupants to safety. If the squad needs to be at point X right now, it's on you to find a path. Even if that means gunning the engine through rubble, shell craters, or walls that could flip the vehicle if misjudged. Every jolt and swerve, you've got troops in the back getting tossed around or yelling at you. And Emperor forbid something goes wrong mechanically. If the Chimera stalls or throws a track at a critical moment, the same panicked troopers might justifiably, if unfairly, blame you. Inside the Chimera, conditions are rough, it's noisy. The engines roaring beneath you, the tracks clanking, the turret above thumping away. The intercom might crackle or fail, so you sometimes just feel thuds and screams without clear context. Communication with the outside world is limited to what the commander shouts at you or comes through the vox. Enemy hits still rock your bones. A near miss from an artillery shell can leave you half deaf from the clang on the hull. And in battle, if you're buttoned up inside, you might have no idea what's happening beyond your instrument panel and whatever terse orders come down. It's disorienting and terrifying in its own way, like being in a tin can while giants hammer on the outside. Visibility is another killer. Many Chimera drivers recount terrifying moments where they only realized an enemy threat was right in front of them when it was almost too late. Maybe a mob of greenskins bursts out of the tree line, only a stone's throw away, or a hidden anti-armor gun on a ridge suddenly opens up. You react as best as you can, but with limited sight, it's always a gamble. Even a good driver is gambling when half-blind. And if your periscope or view slit gets shattered, say by a sniper round or shrapnel, now you're effectively driving blind. You might as well be fighting with a bag on your head. At that point, you're either stopping, which isn't usually an option under fire, or sticking your head out of the hatch, which is basically asking to be sniped. Neither choice is enviable. Even when things go well, a driver is often unappreciated. Troops pile out the back when you deliver them, rushing off to glory, while you stay with the Chimera to perhaps provide supporting fire with the hull gun or to retrieve the wounded. If a battle turns and a retreat is needed, you may have to drive back through fire to pick up survivors, a harrowing taxi service through a war zone. Not all drivers do. There are stories of panic where transports left early, stranding comrades. But a good driver will push back into the fray to pull his fellow guardsmen out of the fire. It's noble, but often fatal. Many drivers die maneuvering their Chimera to shield retreating infantry or going back for one last man. They rarely get medals for it. At best, they get remembered by the survivors they saved. If, when your Chimera gets knocked out, things get very personal very fast. As the driver, you should be the first one out. There's a hatch by your seat, but often you're injured or dazed from the hit. If you're lucky, someone hauls you out before the cabin becomes an inferno, or enemy gunfire rakes the wreck. If you're unlucky, you come to pinned in the wreckage with fire spreading, or with a broken limb, while everyone else who survived is trying to bail. Being trapped in an enclosed space that's on fire or about to explode is a special kind of horror few can imagine. Some drivers manage to crawl out through twisted metal, badly burned and barely alive, but most do not. In summary, driving a Chimera trades the relative freedom of a foot slogger for the false security of an armored box. You're a prime target for every anti-tank weapon on the field. One hit can turn your transport into a tomb, and even without enemy action, the stress and responsibility of piloting a lumbering metal coffin is immense. It's far from a safe ride. Being a Chimera driver is yet another of the Guard's worst and most dangerous jobs. Trench warfare guard on a death world. If hell has a waiting room, it's an Imperial Guard trench on a death world. Trench warfare is misery on even a normal battlefront, constant damp, filth, rats, disease, relentless shelling. Now, imagine all that, but on a planet so hostile that the environment itself is trying to kill you, even when the enemy isn't. Being stuck guarding trenches on a death world is an unending gauntlet of horror and suffering. Death worlds are planets classified as so lethal to human life that mere survival is a daily victory. Now, put a war on one. The Guard digs trenches because that's the only way to hold ground, but you're digging into poison soil under toxic skies. Start with the environmental hazards. On a death world, you might have to wear a rebreather mask or a full-body hazard suit constantly because the very air or rain can kill. Try wearing a gas mask 24/7 because the atmosphere itself will poison or choke you if you don't. If that gear fails, one tear or clogged filter, you inhale noxious spores or gas and drop in an instant, choking. Some death worlds even have acidic rain. It patters on your helmet and sizzles on your poncho, and you just have to huddle there and take it, praying it doesn't get any worse. The mud in the trench could be teeming with parasites or chemicals that eat at your boots and skin. Every inch of this place is trying to kill you. Then there's local fauna. Death worlds are infamous for deadly creatures. giant toxic bugs crawling into your dugout, tentacled swamp creatures slithering up from the mud. Those are real possibilities. Sometimes the trench is quiet of enemy activity, but you can't sleep because you hear something moving out beyond the wire, or worse, inside the perimeter. Many guardsmen whisper stories of comrades snatched from the firing step in the dead of night by things they never even saw. One second a sentry was there, the next, just a strangled cry and he's gone, dragged into a tunnel or yanked over the parapet by some many-limbed horror. Come dawn, you might find only a blood trail leading off into the jungle, or nothing at all. Your enemy isn't only in front of you. It's all around, lurking in the mud, the sky, the shadows. Continuous bombardment is another joy. Trench warfare means constant artillery exchanges. On a death world, each shell blast doesn't just throw shrapnel. It might release clouds of hazardous spores or fling venomous debris from shattered carnivorous plants your way. Gas attacks are common. Enemies love to drop chemical shells, which mix with the planet's own miasma, to become an even more grotesque, flesh-melting fog. You scramble for your mask, if you aren't wearing it already, and hope the filter holds out. Being caught in a trench when a gas shell hits. Imagine coughing up your lungs while also fending off whatever poisonous insects the blast stirred up from the ground. It's beyond nightmarish. Nighttime in the trenches of a death world is perhaps the most harrowing time. No sunlight, temperatures might plummet or skyrocket. Bizarre bioluminescent fungi cast eerie glows on the parapets. Your own shadows play tricks on you. Fatigue sets in and you start seeing things, or worse, not seeing the very real threats slithering toward you. Sleep is a rarity and men go mad from the stress. There are tales of sentries simply wandering off into the toxic jungle, driven insane by hallucinations or sheer terror. It got so bad in one campaign that commissars literally chained soldiers to their heavy bolter posts to stop them from deserting their watch in delirium. It gets that horrific. And unlike in more mobile wars, you don't get to leave. A trench war on a death world can drag on for months or years, the front scarcely moving. You might sit in that hellish ditch for so long, you forget what a warm meal or dry socks feel like. Each day you grow weaker from poor rations, because supply lines struggle when the whole planet is hostile. More disease-ridden, there's always some alien fungus or rot eating away at your flesh, and more mentally broken. The idea of rotation or relief is a cruel joke. Fresh troops can hardly survive long enough to make a difference. Eventually, the trench might become your grave, whether by enemy action or the planet slowly chewing you up. To conclude, a trench guard on a death world faces every horror of war, plus a planet that actively tries to murder you. The air, the rain, the mud, the beasts around you. Everything is hostile. You endure constant shelling, deadly weather, unseen predators, lethal infections, and unending fear with no respite or escape. It's a living nightmare that breaks all but the hardest souls. Without question, it's one of the most miserable and deadly duties an Imperial Guardsman can have. Regimental Standard Bearer. At first glance, carrying the regiment's banner might seem like an honor rather than a horrid job. The standard bearer gets to hold aloft the proud colors of his regiment, a symbol of courage meant to inspire the troops and remind the enemy that the guard will never falter. But peel back the heroic propaganda and take a look at what that job actually entails on a battlefield. You are literally the one guy who cannot keep his head down. You're the one holding a big bright flagpole in the middle of a war zone. On battlefields where survival often means staying low and inconspicuous, you're marching around with a giant shoot here first sign. In battle, the standard is supposed to be a rallying point, a beacon of hope. To the enemy, it's an obvious bullseye. So guess who the enemy will aim at first, the big shining target waving above the trench line. Enemy snipers zero in on standard bearers with relish. Take out the banner and you break the formation's spirit. Even the most dim-witted orc or crazed cultist can recognize a banner and think, "That looks important, smash it." As the standard bearer, you become a bullet magnet. Your lifespan in a firefight is only marginally better than that of the guy carrying the flamer, and we've established how short that is. Consider your defensive options. One hand is always on the flagpole, which leaves you only one hand for a weapon or to cling to cover. Not that cover does much when you have to stand tall and keep the flag flying. If a power-armored foe charges, you can't even properly parry. One hand is busy with the flag, so your attempts at defense or attack are clumsy at best. Many standard bearers end up planting the flag in the ground to draw a weapon, only to be cut down anyway and see the banner captured. To die in defense of the flag is tragic. To live having lost it is considered an unforgivable shame. Physically, that standard isn't light either. Banners are heavy cloth, often laden with purity seals, battle honors, and a big chunk of metal on top in the shape of an aquila or regimental crest. Holding it up for hours is exhausting. Your arm and shoulder burn, your back aches. If you have to advance at a run with it, the banner catches every gust of wind and pulls at you, making you stagger and slowing you down. It's a workout even without people shooting at you. With incoming fire, it's a nightmare. And you can't just lower it to rest. The whole point is to keep it high, visible to all, come hell or high water. From the enemy's perspective, killing a standard bearer is a big psychological win. They know if they drop that flag, Imperial morale might waver. So enemies will go out of their way to eliminate you and capture that banner. The enemy might not even kill you outright. They might aim to wound you so you drop the standard, or shoot the banner pole so it falls. Some particularly nasty foes will make a spectacle of it. They'll snatch the banner and parade it to taunt your side. The enemy will go to great lengths to kill you and seize or defile the flag for effect. It's not just warfare, it's psychological warfare. And you're the unfortunate focal point. Within your own ranks, there's enormous pressure to stand and die rather than yield an inch. You are entrusted with this honor because of proven bravery, and you're expected to be the last to retreat. If you even think of dipping that flag, a commissar or officer will roar at you to keep it high. Losing the standard is such a disgrace that it's often said a unit whose banner is taken might as well be wiped out. Historically, entire regiments have been disbanded or executed for the shame of losing their colors. So any rational thought, like live to fight another day, doesn't apply. You fight until either you or the banner is in the dirt, preferably both from the command's perspective. The standard bearer is essentially expected to choose death over the slightest blemish on that flag's honor. When the standard moves, everyone notices. Friend and foe alike. Allies look to it and gather around it for courage, and enemies concentrate fire to drag it down. A knot of men around a flag quickly attracts grenades, sniper rounds, and artillery strikes. The standard bearer stands at the eye of a storm of violence. Battles have pivoted around the location of a fallen banner, entire squads charging or dying in attempts to retrieve it, while the enemy pours everything they have into keeping it down. For you, this means even more attention focused on your already perilous position. Standard bearers carry a sidearm or sword, but with one hand occupied, it's little comfort. You might manage a few last pistol shots or a one-handed swing of a chainsword, but it's not likely to fend off a determined enemy for long. You usually have to rely on nearby comrades to protect you, if any are left. In the chaos of battle, you might find yourself suddenly very alone with a very large flag, as enemies rush to claim your prize. Not a great predicament. In summary, being a regimental standard bearer is a great honor, wrapped in near certain doom. You are literally the banner of the Emperor's will on the field, and also a giant bullseye. Heroic? Undeniably. But the job of holding that flag often means being shot, stabbed, or blown apart in very short order. The Imperial Guard venerates its standard bearers in songs and paintings precisely because so few live to tell the tale. It is without doubt one of the worst, if most glorified, assignments a guardsman can receive, a duty where valor and fatality walk hand in hand. Penal Legionnaire. Being a soldier in a penal legion is as close as it gets to a living death sentence in the Guard. These are condemned criminals pressed into service. They march into battle with explosive collars locked around their necks, a constant reminder that if they falter or try to flee, their superiors will literally blow their heads off. Penal legionnaires are given minimal equipment and zero expectation of survival. A last gun with a single charge pack, maybe a shiv or a demo charge. That's it. They're thrown at the enemy's strongest positions, used to soak up bullets or clear minefields by walking over them. Expendable doesn't begin to cover it. These convicts are the first wave in suicidal assaults no one else would dare attempt. Herded forward by armed overseers, they're there to draw enemy fire and die gloriously and horribly for the Emperor. Discipline is maintained by pure fear. Commissars and minders accompany them, fingers on the detonator for those callers. Any sign of disobedience or hesitation and pop. One less convict to worry about. Some penal troops are even pumped full of combat drugs like Frenzon before a charge, turning them into berserkers who feel no pain. Under the influence or not, they charge headlong at enemy gun lines because the only alternative is instant decapitation via explosive collar. It gets them to advance when any sane man would run the other way, at least for a few minutes until they're cut down. There's no real camaraderie here, just desperation. You're fighting alongside murderers, thieves, heretics, the disposable scum of the Imperium. Trust is non-existent. Fights often break out in the ranks. Some convicts might kill each other over a scrap of food or a perceived slight, and the overseers won't care unless it interrupts the mission. Many penal legionnaires know they're dead men walking and act like it. Some charge with suicidal recklessness. Others are paralyzed by terror or simply broken inside. Any thought of glory or survival is a cruel joke. Virtually none of them will ever earn the Emperor's pardon. In extremely rare cases, a penal trooper might survive a dozen missions and perform some act of incredible heroism, earning a pardon and induction into a normal unit, but most consider that about as likely as winning the lottery twice. For a penal legionnaire, life expectancy is measured in minutes of combat. They're literally sent in as human shields, distraction units, and cannon fodder. If a commander needs a fortified bunker overrun, he'll send in the penal legion first to soak up the enemy's ammunition. If there's a minefield blocking the advance, the penal troops get to march through it to clear the mines with their bodies. Their lives are spent with wanton disregard. The Imperium figures they're traitors or criminals who deserve no better. It's horrifying and tragic even by the bleak standards of the 41st millennium. Serving in a penal legion is without doubt one of the worst fates a guardsman can endure. The only redemption these convicts find is through death in battle and the Emperor's judgment in the afterlife. We have seen the fate of those guardsmen saddled with the most perilous and miserable duties. From the flamer operator who carries his own fiery death on his back, to the medic who races through hell to save a comrade, to the penal legionary sent running at enemy guns with a bomb collar around his neck. Each of these roles is a near certain death sentence. They exemplify the Imperial Guard's grim truth. Victory is built on unimaginable human sacrifice. Yet these doomed souls still step up and do their duty. Whether out of faith, fear, or sheer grit, they charge forward when any sane person would run. In the horror of the 41st millennium, someone must ignite the trenches, carry the wounded, feed the guns, drive into the jaws of death, hold the banner high, and march into the teeth of oblivion. The worst jobs in the Guard fall to those unlucky or brave enough to accept them, and through their suffering and sacrifice, the Imperium of Man endures. Only in death does their duty end, and for these poor guardsmen, that end usually comes far too soon.